Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Zvika Krieger, representative to Silicon Valley and senior advisor for technology and innovation at the U.S. Department of State. Could you tell us more about the Global Entrepreneurship Summit? What's the mission of the GSE? Who participates and why is it so important?
The Global Entrepreneurship Summit, which is what has been a global gathering that we've done in different countries every year for the past 8 years. And we decided to do it this last year in Silicon Valley. And we brought over 1,000 entrepreneurs and investors from over 170 countries to Silicon Valley. And we did a week-long conference with President Obama came, Secretary of State Kerry. We had Mark Zuckerberg, and we had the CEOs or founders of Google and Airbnb and Uber and LinkedIn and all the big tech companies. And we had, you know, 50 different workshops, breakout sessions, speed mentoring, coaching, pitch competitions, field trips all over Silicon Valley. And so that was a massive effort that we undertook. And we continue to do a lot of outreach where we bring Silicon Valley leaders to our embassies around the world so they can do tech boot camps and training and help grow the entrepreneurial ecosystems around the world. And so a lot of our job is sort of connecting the tech community with our embassies. And that actually gets to our fourth line of effort, which is around sort of being an embassy, a kind of embassy. Here you sort of joke about that title of an ambassador to Silicon Valley. In many ways, this is a foreign country. And so we spend a lot of time, first of all, working with our senior officials in Washington.
So, Zvika, would you highlight your key accomplishments to date? And what is your hope for this office as it evolves?
So I would say that we've had a lot of great accomplishments. What's been really inspiring out here is being able to work at the speed of the private sector rather than the speed of government. And a lot of the challenge has been helping push along a paradigm shift where, you know, there's a big zeitgeist in government right now around public-private partnerships. And I think there's a lot of value to public-private partnerships, but that's also a legal term where you're entering into a partnership with a private sector entity, and there's a MOU that has to be signed, and there's restrictions on it, and that can very much, you know, slow people down out here, and can make them not want to work with the government. So what we've been working on a lot out here is how do we move beyond public-private partnerships to, you know, highlight the areas in which we think the private sector can make a big impact, convene the right people in the room, facilitate the right conversations, generate the ideas, bring our expertise to bear, link people together for coalitions around executing ideas, and then get out of the way. And not everything the State Department has to be, have a State Department stamp on the program, as long as we have the impact that we're looking for. So let's look, for example, at the refugee issue, which was the first initiative that we launched out here. Some of the things that came out of that included a big partnership that we had with Google, where they've been doing some great work sending 10,000 Chromebooks to refugee camps or building technology tools that can be used by educators and teachers to educate the 2.5 million Syrian refugee children that are currently outside of school. Efforts that they've launched to bring Wi-Fi to refugee camps. You know, that wasn't an official public-private partnership with Google. It's something that we were able to work with them to help identify needs, but then something that they executed on their own. And, another example is working with Coursera, the online education platform, to help open their platform to refugees and not just the free courses they have on there, but to allow refugees to take the sort of certificate programs that they have so that they can look for new jobs. And so are they, so we've had over 1,000 refugees that have now gotten certificates through this opportunity that Coursera has offered. And a third example is working with Airbnb to think about how we can leverage their platform to help refugees that are being resettled and may need emergency housing as a transition when they're being resettled in a new country. And so these are examples of how we can leverage the expertise, different expertise from different tech companies. You know, tech companies, they're not like the corporations of yore, like, you know, Walmart or, you know, corporate philanthropies where they just throw cash at a challenge. They really want to leverage the unique expertise and the resources they have in their companies to solve them. So a lot of the work that we do here is working individually with each company to say, well, what platform do you have? What resources do you have? And how can we match that with the specific elements of the challenge? And so those are some examples of what we've done with refugees. On the nuclear proliferation front, we've launched a number of really fascinating, almost science fiction level partnerships between academic institutions and tech companies out here, whether it's creating a platform where amateurs can help crowdsource analysis of satellite imagery to detect nuclear testing sites, whether we can create an algorithm to look at e-commerce websites and see if they are selling dual use technology inadvertently, or even exploring whether the accelerator on your smartphone could be used to help detect underground nuclear test sites. And so that's been fascinating. And I could go on and on, but you know, the fact that we've been able on each of these initiatives to have 5 or 6 concrete projects that have not just been announced, but that are actually out in the field being used or piloted right now, it's enough to make my government head explode in terms of the speed that the private sector is able to accomplish things.
So, Zvika, I understand you are a fan of design thinking and other uses for post-it notes. But first, what is design thinking? What are the integral steps or components to it? And how have you used design thinking at your work at State?
Sure. And so my work in design thinking, goes all the way back to my undergrad, which I studied political science, but I also studied design and was always looking at how could we take the tools of the design world and apply them beyond the aesthetic world of just, you know, people hear design and they think, you know, how to make things look pretty. And so they are, how can we take some of their creativity tools and apply them to the policymaking world? And, when I was working at the Defense Department, innovation became a buzzword. In our quadrennial defense review, which is DOD's 4-year strategy, the QDR, the word innovation was mentioned 72 times. And when we sat down after the launch of the QDR with our senior leadership, one of our senior leaders said, so what do we mean by the word innovation? And there was just crickets in the room. And I think that, you know, it's a buzzword that a lot of leaders want to get behind, but how do we make it real? And so I actually spent about a year when I was at the Defense Department studying the private sector and looking at the most innovative companies across the private sector to see how do they scale innovation? How do they help their workforce get more creative mindsets to break through conventional thinking and generate genuinely new and exciting ideas that can have an impact? And by canvassing the private sector, whether that's, you know, some of the most innovative companies, whether it's business schools, whether it's innovation firms, design thinking really came again and again as the tool that the private sector is using these days to scale innovation across their workforces. And so design thinking, as I mentioned, is basically taking the best tools from design and applying them to challenges across different sectors. And so, you know, the key, if you really had to, you get every design thinking expert, for every design thinking expert you ask, you'll get a different definition of what is design thinking. But to give you kind of the, for example, the Stanford Design School's approach to design thinking is that there's five sort of components of a design process, which is one is empathy, which is making sure that you understand the needs of your users. And that's why design thinking is often called human-centered design, because it puts the needs of the human front and center. So really immersing yourself in whatever challenge the users or whoever's needs you're actually trying to meet. Number two is synthesis. And so how do you get inputs from a wide variety of places? I mentioned earlier that one of the keys to innovation is bringing diverse perspectives to the table. So how do you bring those perspectives to the table and then extract the insights out of those perspectives that will be useful in your process? Third is problem framing. So how do you ensure that that the problem you're tackling is actually the right problem? And I know that this is particularly relevant, or I've seen this be particularly relevant in government, where sometimes a senior leader will say, launch me an initiative on X, or, solve this problem. And you scratch the surface and realize that actually that's not the right problem. That's just a symptom of a larger problem. And so design thinking has tools for help you make sure that you're actually solving the right problem. And then once you know you have the right problem, the next step or the next kind of approach is ideation, which is basically a fancy word for brainstorming. But it's more than that in the sense of how do you go really broad to look for ideas? How do you really juice your creativity so that you're not just replicating what's already been done, but that you're actually challenging the conventional wisdom and really sort of thinking out of the box and thinking bold, big and bold. And then the last piece is then going back to what we were talking about with the lean methodology. And I would say that design and lean are probably cousins and more similar than their evangelists would like to admit. But the last part is, what we call prototyping, testing, and iterating, which is rather than waiting till the end to launch a new product and see that it doesn't work, how can we prototype something in a very low fidelity way, test it with users, learn from those tests, and constantly iterate and go through that prototype, test, iterate, prototype, test, iterate cycle. And, there is certainly a skepticism that a lot of people in government sort of feel when they come in contact with design thinking, when they think, this is a tool for the private sector. This is a tool for developing products. What does this have to do with the government? And, through my work at the Defense Department, at the State Department, and actually, facilitating workshops all across government agencies, I've been able to see design tools adapted to a whole variety of circumstances, whether, first of all, government does create products. And I think the fact that people in government don't recognize that we have customers is sometimes part of the problem. The American people are often the customer of our products. But beyond that, I've seen design thinking used to generate strategies or systems or programs or any wide variety of tasks that fall to government. And so I found it to be an incredibly useful tool and something that really scratches the itch of senior leadership when they say, we want to be innovative. We want to launch, an innovation initiative. Well, when you ask what that means, design thinking can answer that question in a way that is tangible and it's teachable and it's something that can be scaled across a workforce. And so I've become a really big fan of that. And of course, Silicon Valley is design thinking is de rigueur out here. It really defines the culture out here. And so I've been able to So it's been nice to be out here where it's second nature, and I can see it, how it really bears fruit out here.
So what is it with the Post-it notes? How are they helpful in your efforts? And more importantly, how have you used them to innovate and co-create?
Sure. I mean, I would say, you know, don't get distracted by the Post-it notes. They're just a tool. But the reason we use Post-it notes is, first of all, they are democratizing. They help create a meritocracy in terms of you write your idea on a Post-it note and you put it up on a wall and nobody knows who wrote that idea. It could be a cabinet secretary, or it could be an intern. And so it really helps foster a meritocracy of ideas in that sense. And it also is, helps bring out creativity from people who may not be most verbal. We've all been in meetings where the loudest voice in the room wins, so people who might be more introverted or might have more, you know, of a written approach to ideation, it helps bring out the ideas from different personality types in a group. And it's also very collaborative. You get everything up on a wall. You make it visual so that everybody can be working together, and you can have diverse teams collaborating. And so those are just a couple of the ideas and reasons why I use sticky notes. I would say probably in some ways one of the most important ones for government is they also force concision. And so there's only so much you can fit on a 3-inch by 3-inch sticky note. So get to the point with your ideas rather than writing, you know, a 5-page memo. And so I find that particularly useful in the government context.
So, Zvika, in closing, what advice would you give someone who is thinking about a career in public service?
What I would say is don't be bounded by the conventional wisdom about government. I came into government originally at the Defense Department working for Ash Carter when he was the Deputy Defense Secretary. And I thought I would only be in government for a year or two, and I would go back to being a journalist, which is what I did before I was in government. And I was just amazed at the sort of opportunities for innovators in government. And I think that there's a lot of assumptions about what you can and can't do. And my question is always, why? If someone says, well, you can't do that, and I'll ask why. And unless there's like a law or a regulation, I ask people to, you know, point it to me, show me where it says we can't do this. And a lot of it is just inertia and habits and customs and traditions that nobody even knows that why we do them or have sort of outgrown their usefulness. And so there is room for innovators in government. And I would even argue there's a need, a dire need for innovators in government. So for people who are for really creative folks out there who are looking to make an impact, there's a real renaissance in government right now for innovators and a real demand for them. So I would strongly recommend you try and try your hand at public service, because it can be frustrating at times, and we certainly have our bureaucracy, but the ability to have impact is unparalleled.
Zvika, that's terrific advice. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Zvika Krieger, representative to Silicon Valley and senior advisor for technology and innovation at the U.S. Department of State. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.